From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is contributing editor to the National Journal, Tom DeFrank.
Good day. Here are today's issues in the news from Washington. A terrorist attack in New York killed 8 people. The suspect is an Uzbek national who's been in the United States for 7 years. A special prosecutor investigating Russia's attempts to influence the 2016 election charged 3 members of President Trump's campaign, including his former campaign manager. And President Trump has begun a trip to Asia that will focus on North Korea's nuclear weapons threat and trade issues. Well, we have seen car bombings for a long time by terrorists. We've also seen where terrorists rent a truck and then drive over people. The worst of these in recent years was in Nice, France, which killed several dozen people. Now this new technique, new sick technique, I should say, has come to the United States. Saipulo Saipov, a 29-year-old Uzbek, was the alleged perpetrator. He has been charged. President Trump has called him an animal and said he should be executed. Oren, what else do we know about him?
Well, he came here on what's called the diversity lottery, which is basically a lottery that allows some 50,000 people to come into the United States from almost anywhere around the world. They're not allowed to come if they're convicted criminals or members of terrorist organizations, but otherwise it's basically a lottery. The president has said that he wants to end this program, and it's causing a little bit of a political hay, I guess, very close to the time of this terrorist attack.
It's once again become a case where President Trump wants to take action, and that's how he wants to be seen. There was an attack in his hometown, New York City. 8 people killed. 6 of them were foreigners, by the way, visitors from other countries. That's the way things are in New York. And ironically, and probably intentionally by the terrorist, it was right next to the site of the World Trade Center, the major attack of 9/11. 16 years ago. So Trump declared that he wants to end this lottery program that the White House claims hardly checks who these people are. Just the most minimal of checking, that they don't have a criminal record in their home country and that they have a high school education. No interrogation by security authorities, no questioning by the U.S. Embassy to find out, what do you want to do in the United States? Will you actually contribute to America? It's really resonating here in this country with people who pay attention that it's okay to bring in immigrants. And that is what the White House is saying, though we generally have a tone that they don't want so many immigrants as in the past. But the White House is saying everyone should be checked. Will they contribute to U.S. society? And this terrorist Saipov was allowed in at age 22 from Uzbekistan, and Trump says that was clearly a mistake.
The Diversity Visa Lottery, which is its official name, has been around since 1995, and it was authorized on a bipartisan basis. Now, the president is saying this was the brainchild of Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. It should also be noted that members of Congress have felt like that this was a problem. This was a flawed program, as Dan has suggested. There was less vetting. The other thing is, if you win the lottery, so to speak, you don't have to show that you have a job. You don't have to show you have a sponsor in the United States.
So you're in. You have the right to live and work in this country. So it's amazing. It's considered a golden ticket. But that word diversity, it's because Congress determined, and it really was bipartisan, that America should have people from all around the world of every color and ethnicity. So the question is, and I'm sure our listeners around the world will wonder, does America still want that?
So what's interesting about this program is that it was initially created to give more of a chance to Irish and Italian immigrants. And because the economics, by the time the law actually passed, the economics in Ireland changed, it ended up benefiting more Africans and Central Asians and Turks and Bulgarians, people from Eastern Europe. But yeah, the advocates say that that many of these immigrants have driven U.S. economic growth, that they've been entrepreneurs, that they come here and get an education, and that the United States doesn't have the same demographic-based economic problems that Europe and Japan do, for instance, because we have this type of immigration from other countries. But the critics are saying that if we allow people from other countries, we should bring them in on a merit-based system, screening them in advance for what they would add to the American economy.
Right, but I think it's very likely that this program is going to be scaled back. I mean, in 2013, when there was a real attempt in Congress to have a comprehensive immigration reform enacted, the legislation which passed the Senate would have done away with this program. But for a variety of reasons, it died in the Republican-led House of Representatives, who they didn't like this program, but they didn't like some other provisions of the bill that would have allegedly made it easier for undocumented immigrants to stay in the country.
I think it's fair to note that Senator Schumer, who was one of the sponsors of the 1995 law, was also one of the sponsors of the 2013 bill that would have done away with this program.
That's right. So what do you think happens, Dan? I mean, the president is very vehement about this. He says no more of this diversity stuff. We need to have a merit-based. And it's probably, I'm just guessing that the polls will show that that's a fairly popular sentiment right now.
I would think too, but it doesn't necessarily lead to comprehensive immigration reform that includes what to do about immigrants who are already in the United States, often undocumented without papers. That's, of course, a big focus for President Trump. He wants to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. He says that those people are troublemakers, and that's the general image he wants to give. And that's why, again, the image of America is what's under a cloud or a question right now as to whether we are so open and welcoming. In the age of Trump, and it's only been 1 year since his election, I think the tone has changed.
Right, absolutely.
So there's another element that he wants to do away with, which is what he calls chain immigration, and other people call the family reunification program of the U.S. visa program, immigration system. And this allows immigrants who do have green cards or do have citizenship to also sponsor their children, their adult children's spouses, their parents, their siblings.
And Saipov, the alleged terrorist in New York, right? President Trump said that Saipov was able to bring in 23
right.
relatives that way.
Right. So, again, the critics and the president say that this has caused, you know, uncontrolled mushrooming immigration. Supporters say that family unification is one of the things that shows that America is open to the world. But the president wants to trade what part of what you were describing about the people who are already here. There's the deferred action DACA,
which is for children who were brought in by their
parents. Children who were brought in by their
parents.
He wants to allow that to remain and turn into law.
So-called dreamers.
The dreamers.
Dreamers.
And but in return, he wants the Democrats to support an end to what he calls chain immigration or family reunification.
And building that wall.
And building the wall.
Yeah, so there's going to be lots of negotiations to see how this sorts out, but I think it's fair to say it's probably likely that this particular program, the lottery system, which President Trump called a Democrat lottery system, it's probably, fair or not, I think it's probably going to be scaled back some, for sure. I mean, before we go to another subject, I want to just mention the irony of this attack in New York. I mean, it's ironic because there's no question that ISIS is on the run in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and Iraq. Iraqi forces aided and abetted by American troops, a lot of special forces, have made dramatic gains in the last 2 years in pushing ISIS out of a lot of its territory. But experts have said that's the good news. The bad news is ISIS and other terrorists are going to go to smaller scale attacks because they're easier to pull off and harder to detect. And that's what has happened here. And you get this awful feeling, Dan, that Mr. Saipov, who has now been charged in these murders, was easy for him and anybody else to just run a truck.
It may be part of life in this modern age. And it's right. As the Islamic State, ISIS, is being defeated in Iraq and Syria, that organization will keep inspiring some extremists in Western countries, including the U.S.
Right. Let us turn now to the probe by Robert Mueller, a special prosecutor who has been looking into Russian attempts to influence the 2016 presidential election. A Washington grand jury has indicted two lobbyists, including former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, on multiple counts of money laundering, conspiracy, and other alleged crimes. A third individual, who was an unpaid low-level campaign volunteer, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and has been cooperating with Mr. Mueller's probe. Now, we should be clear that the indictments did not mention the Trump campaign, and President Trump and his advisors have once again vigorously insisted there was no collusion on the part of his campaign. But all three of these individuals were affiliated with the campaign. Orrin, how big of a problem potentially is this for President Trump in this ongoing investigation?
Well, it's hard to say for sure, but this stage of the investigation, of the indictments and arrests and guilty pleas, is just getting started. So this is basically the FBI is following the pattern of a RICO investigation, where they go after
racketeering,
where they go after low-level officials, low-level associates, and get them to turn against higher-level associates and to provide testimony and information about people near the top. In this case, I think the most interesting, a lot of the stuff about Manafort and Gates was already part of the public record. People knew about their work in Ukraine and in Russia, and working with high-level Ukrainian and Russian officials who are close to the Russian government. But we didn't know a whole lot about George Papadopoulos, and I find his guilty plea and the information that was presented with that the most interesting, because he had multiple attempts of trying to connect the Trump campaign with Russian officials, and he sent a lot of emails. There's a big long email record of him communicating with top level Trump campaign officials and telling them about his efforts to talk to people about who claim to have dirt on, in quotes, dirt on Hillary Clinton, and to also set up a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Of course, that's important, whether candidate Trump knew that someone in his campaign, albeit an unpaid volunteer, Papadopoulos, had contacts with people in London who spoke about giving negative information, including hacked emails, to the Trump campaign, and maybe even Trump should get together with Vladimir Putin. Did Trump hear about it? In interviews, he has said, no one in my campaign, as far as I know, had any contacts with Russians. And the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, he was a senator last year who was very active in the Trump campaign. Well, there's a photo of Trump and Sessions and Papadopoulos and others at a planning meeting. And the question arises whether everyone's telling the truth or not. Papadopoulos, of course, admitted lying to FBI agents, and we wonder if now his account is truthful.
Well, the White House quickly moved to label him a liar. We're going to talk a lot more about this topic and Mr. Papadopoulos in just a moment, but we're going to take a short break here.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. This is a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Orrin Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and moderator Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal.
Now, let's go back to George Papadopoulos and this investigation. I mean, I think Dan and Orrin, you both hit the nail on the head here. Papadopoulos has pleaded guilty to lying to the government. So that makes him an easy target for the White House and the president's defenders who say, well, he's a liar, so he's probably lied about everything. But we will see about this. The only other thing I would say is that I know that the White House was caught by surprise about the Papadopoulos indictment or a guilty plea. The president and his press secretary have continued to say, we think this investigation will end very soon.
It's got to be wishful thinking, Tom.
I think so, Dan. I've covered a lot of these, as all three of us have, and usually the first indictments are not the beginning of the end. It's usually the end of the beginning. And for instance, there is nothing in this first wave of indictments or guilty pleas that have anything to do with retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who is widely believed to be a key target of investigators.
Mm-hmm. And for a while, he was National Security Advisor in the White House until fired. You know, mostly what for? For supposedly lying to Vice President Pence about Flynn's foreign contacts.
Right. Exactly right. And he was forced out after 24 days as the president's National Security Advisor. And just as there was widespread expectation that Mr. Manafort and his business partner were going to be indicted, there is a widespread sense that General Flynn, when all is said and done, is going to be indicted as well. We will just have to see. We will have to see. Now, Oren, there is a ancillary piece of fascinating piece of information here about the Russians' attempt to influence the election in November a year ago this month. And that is the whole role of the Russians and social media. Now, social media mandarins told Congress a few days ago that Russia's interference or attempts to interfere in the election may be more extensive than originally thought. The Russians' operatives purchased hundreds of ads, maybe 3,000 ads on social media, and all of which were attempts to influence public opinion in that election. What can you say about this and where it goes from here, Oren?
Well, so I'm laughing because we've been writing about this sort of thing for months. So it's interesting to see Google and Twitter and Facebook come forward and actually talk about what their records contain. But what they described basically was a pattern of Russians basically buying, not only buying ads, but also organizing events and recruiting people in the United States to organize events, and sometimes pushing them or encouraging them to engage in violence for both sides, opposing sides, to engage in violence at these events. There was one in Texas. So they were basically trying to gin up the violence and the fighting between the left and the right in this country, and without anyone realizing who was behind it and that they were behind it.
Oren, did you get the impression in that congressional testimony, mainly by Twitter and Facebook, it's really the ones that we noticed, that they agreed with the notion that the Russian meddling seemed to be on behalf of Donald Trump, or more specifically, against Hillary Clinton? That still was the general tone, I thought, as well as just trying to cause unrest in the U.S.
Right. But, I mean, there's a lot of evidence, I would say, that the Russian social media still is very hard on Hillary Clinton and is still rather soft on Donald Trump. And I thought that I saw a message from Maria Zakharova, who's the Russian foreign ministry spokesman or Russian government spokeswoman, saying that so apparently now Twitter is not taking these ads anymore from the Russians. And she said that that's an example or evidence of Twitter's subjugation to the U.S. government.
What the Russians did in 2016, it's fair to say they will do again in 2020, because in addition to the were they for Trump or against Hillary or whatever, part of the Russian game here, it's a serious game, is to destabilize Western democracies. And so you can be sure, however the 2016 calculation sorts out, they, the Russians, will be back at this in 2016. Now, in the few minutes we have left, let's go to President Trump's foreign trip. He has begun the longest trip of his presidency, a 12-day, five-nation visit to Japan, China, South Korea, Vietnam, and the Philippines. It's the longest trip to Asia by a president of the United States in about a quarter of a century. Quite elaborate, quite intensive 12 days of diplomacy. Dan, what do you think the president really hopes to accomplish? I assume everybody's saying the two main things he's trying to do is deal with North Korea and deal with trade. So what's your take on
that? Those are definitely the main points, but North Korea comes first because the Trump White House puts security first. And his national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, told reporters just before the trip that the focus is on North Korea and getting a regional coalition, including China, which is certainly something that's been said by the Trump White House all year, but they mean now face-to-face, President Trump meeting with President Xi of China. That's the important set of meetings, I would say, above all.
Orrin, as we all know, President Trump has met with President Xi before. He had an elaborate bilateral meeting with him at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump's Florida resort and club. So this is not the first time they've done this, but as Dan says, this is really going to be the most intensive one-on-one between the two. The White House has said, General McMaster and others have said, that China is becoming more receptive to really, truly cracking down on North Korea. Do you see evidence of that?
Yes and no. I would say that the Chinese are saying that that the North Korean nuclear program, they actually say that it's a threat to themselves, which is, I think you have to take it. I'm not sure you can take that at complete face value, but because a lot of the equipment and funding that goes into the North Korean nuclear program comes from China, but that's what they say, and they are proposing that the United States and North Korea, deal with this basically between themselves, that they talk to each other. Which is something that the Trump administration has begun to try to do a little bit, but I think that this meeting between Xi and Trump is likely to be, I'd love to be a fly on that wall in that room.
Yeah. Well, very briefly, I just want to mention trade because one of the first things President Trump did was decide not to proceed with TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was an idea of the Obama administration to box China out and have a trade deal with more than a dozen countries around the Pacific. So that's gone. So now the Trump administration is committed to having one-on-one deals with all those countries he's visiting and more.
The question is whether that helps China, which many people think it does, or whether it provides additional leverage maybe for the Trump administration to try to refloat something like TPP or something, something different that would be similar to TPP. But the issue here is that the Chinese have a lot of leverage in East Asia. I think that the fact that the way this trip is being described as an effort to strengthen engagement in the Indo-Pacific countries, it kind of leaves out the whole idea of Asia and China out of the title. But China is really the big question mark in this entire effort to change the North Korean behavior, because they control so much of the trade that North Korea does with the rest of the world.
Well, a week from today, when we are back at these microphones, President Trump will still be abroad. And I suspect we will know a lot more about these issues, and we'll have a much better feel, I believe, about where the Chinese really are, and where we as a nation and we as a global entity are heading towards what happens with North Korea. But that's all the time we have today. Thanks to Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News, and Orrin Darrell of USA Today, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for National Journal. Thanks for listening.